Welcome to the Hot Stove Society Show. I'm Tom Douglas. We are here at the Hot Stove Society in downtown Seattle, 4th and Virginia. And my good buddy Chef Terry has got the day off. Madeline's going to jump in for Terry today. I'm going to be asking you some questions.
Oh, boy.
Because our producer Madeline likes to trip me up when it comes to our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. So we're going to have a little something for her today. Plus, you're a short timer, right? This is your second to the last show.
I know. So sad.
Madeline is moving on to Seattle Academy.
Yes.
Up there on Capitol Hill and going to be marketing director. Is that right?
Marketing communications director in the world of schools.
And it boggles my mind, the idea that you'd want to go back to school. You even went to college and you still want to go back to school. I couldn't wait to get out of school.
I know. This is a whole different world, though. I mean, I will be talking about all the prospective parents. You know how I love to ham it up with those people.
And now, when you were at Chapman University, you were the admissions person, right, as your job?
Yeah, had to give tours, campus tours back. I perfected the art of walking backwards.
You know, Loretta, when she was after college, she gave tours of the Capitol and places like that for Senator Cantwell's office.
Yeah, that's right.
So my daughter, Loretta.
It's a good skill.
It's a good skill to have. Anyway, we have a big show. I like I said, I'm Tom Douglas. I'm owner of a few restaurants that are still open around town. One being C-Town, which is kicking it. It's our only restaurant that has outdoor seating with heaters and fire pits now.
They're so cute, don't they?
Yeah, it's really cute to drive by there and see the fire pits. I'm not sure if it makes it look like Skid Row. Remember all like the corner burn barrels at Skid Row?
Yeah.
It kind of has that little bit of feeling to it, but it's really the north end of the market is very nice and posh. And it's the active neighborhood. I would say it's a very active neighborhood. So C-Town is still open, serving fish and chips and chicken pot pie and all that kind of lusciousness. And Serious Pie Downtown is still open for it to go. So that's been fun. And our doc, our Serious Takeout, is open for our Serious Pie Ballard and for our Dinner Box series coming off the dock. We have so much coming out right now, right before Christmas.
A lot.
Our last Christmas boxes are hitting the website today, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, they're all up there now for almost the rest of the year.
Right.
So
we have New Year's. We've got so much going on. And then it's January. And then we just want to kill ourselves. although I'm really excited because we have what we're calling down at C-Town. I'm going to be down there all New Year's Eve with Shuck 2020.
Yep.
Because I've been shucking oysters on weekends down there. And we are all, in our company, I would imagine many of you listening, are ready to see 2020 go bye-bye. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to shuck 2020, have a little party out on the sidewalk, social distancing required. There are some seats and heaters, but I'm going to be down there all day, and it's going to be fun. We're going to have something at the warehouse, too, right?
We're going to do a royal send-off to 2020 with the Palace Burger Royale, I believe.
A lot of people ask for that burger.
Oh, man. When we did our first pop-up, it sold out almost instantly.
Really?
And people just love that burger. It's so symbolic. I think it's also nice. You know, so many people celebrate New Year's Eve downtown back in the day. So I think giving people a little taste of downtown and what they miss at the Palace Kitchen is that burger. We might be attempting some olive poppers. There's rumors of some other Palace Kitchen favorites coming onto the menu, but I think we'll have some fun rivaling C-Town's Shuck 2020.
Yeah, exactly. We have a big show for you today. Like I said, Chef Terry's off today. We have Maggie Trujillo from Heirloom Restaurant, which is down in the north end of the market also, and across from Etta's. If you know where Etta's is, Heirloom is right across next to Cutter's Restaurant. We're going to highlight some of the fun components of our Christmas dinner that we're making, and how do you make a Christmas dinner special? I mean, everyone's been cooking at home much more than they used to, but you still kind of want to go over the top for Christmas dinner or for holiday feast or whatever, however you call it in your household. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. We've got the Baker's Corner coming back because Brittany Bartleman's going to join us from the Met Markets, former Dahlia pastry chef. And we're going to talk crab cakes. You know, one of the things, matter of fact, I did this morning, because we have a big crab cake class this weekend, and many, many people have signed up for it. So we're sending the ingredient box out, and we've pre-made some of the crab cakes. So this morning before the radio show, I made 200 crab cakes.
Whoa.
But it reminded me, you know, I used to make thousands of crab cakes when we had all of our restaurants. And I haven't done it in 9 months. And so it was really fun to kind of get back in there. And all the techniques that go in the crab cakes. So we're going to going to talk about that a bit because there are techniques. It's not just throwing crab in a bowl and doing this and that. There's a lot more to it. So a whole segment on crab cakes. Don't miss that.
Tom, I think you mentioned about making Christmas dinner special. We ended up getting quite a bit of comments for our Kitchen Conundrums Holiday Edition. So that's going to be another fun segment. We got a lot of questions of people, what they want to make this Christmas. So you're going to answer some questions from our listeners who sent in their kitchen conundrums for the holiday.
You often talk about, or we often talk about my wife Jackie being over there at the farm in Prosser. Well, she happens to be in Seattle today, and she's going to come join us for maybe the last hour of the show.
Oh, good.
And so we'll have a little third voice.
Perfect.
A few too many women. Like, there's you, there's Jackie, there's Brittany, there's Miss Trujillo.
Yeah, we're going to gang up on you today.
It's like being back home. You know, I have six sisters. It's going to be like being back in my house. And a daughter and all that kind of stuff. Home for the holidays. So lots of things going on today. Two full hours of goodness. Two COVID-free hours, hopefully. You have COVID every place else. We don't want to talk about it here. My taste of the week, this actually comes from my daughter. You know, Loretta, I don't know why I'm sounding surprised about this, but she's actually become a really good cook. And she's always had great taste buds because, you know, she just has a taste for certain things. I think it's just growing up in a restaurant household. But now she's become a really good cook. And when she was just 16, she worked on the line at the Palace Kitchen. She worked on the line in the catering department. So she has some knowledge about how to go about it. But she loves trying new stuff at home. Her only problem, I mean, to me, my daughter's perfect. Matter of fact, she's got a bun in the oven. Head baker right now. She's got a little boy in the oven. But the only thing that I hold against her is that she likes and craves boneless, skinless chicken breast. Which, if you've heard me talk about chicken on the show and that particular cut, that to me, life is too short to eat boneless, skinless chicken breast. So that's the only area that I have to challenge her on. But she made a dish that was really kind of interesting, like a cheater's paella.
Oh, yeah.
And it was with that Spanish rice, the paella rice, where nice and starchy. So it kind of came together a little bit of a taste of paella, that kind of how the rice sticks together.
Mm-hmm.
With chorizo and chickpeas and just a nice broth, smoked paprika broth. And just mix it all together and throw it in the oven. It's like a cheater's paella.
Yeah.
Because paella, you kind of have to babysit, right?
Sure.
You got all the shrimp and this and that. And this is just the cheater's paella. And it was really good.
Yum. That sounds good. I want that right now.
I don't mean to sound surprised, but it was super good. And we just made a little herb pesto to kind of put over the top of it. Man, fresh and tasty. And I love me some chorizo.
I know. Chorizo chickpea combo is my favorite. It's delicious.
You know, I'm getting to be an adult. I actually like chickpeas. I like beans now.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't love them. I like them.
Yeah, okay. I get it.
Coming up next, it's the ultimate Christmas dinner. We're going to talk about how to survive the big meal. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society Show. Tom Douglas here. Madeline Dow, my producer, is also joining us on the mic today. And
hello.
Maddie, you were going to tell us a little bit about something before we get into the ultimate Christmas dinner that the Tableau Company did, which I think is, and you agree, is really an important kind of step for big companies to think about.
Absolutely. Tableau here in Seattle, you know, they have ton of employees, and for their holiday dinner, they decided it was a big undertaking for them, is what I understand. But they reached out to a lot of our friends and partners, but specifically Ethan of Ethan Stoll Restaurants. He helped really encourage them to spread the love to basically serve dinner to almost over 1,000 of their employees.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was actually close to 4,000, I want to say. They had all different restaurants in the Seattle area come together and divide up the number of dinners. So we had participants, including ourselves, Terra Plata, Brunner and Heel Tap, we had Cafe Campania, Cafe Juanita, all different Larks, all different restaurants across town. You know, and it was one of those things where it was spread the love. It was the ultimate spread the love act this holiday season. And I think a lot of big companies that typically feed and have budgets to feed their employees, especially this time of year, really they got creative by spreading the love and giving that business to restaurants all across town. And I think that there's room for that, especially January, February, when we still might be in lockdown a little bit. And these restaurants, you know, including ourselves, of you said, we've gotten pretty good at packaging up really delicious multi-course dinners and cocktails. And it was a lot of fun. So I want to just give a shout out to Tableau and Ethan Stoll's team for coordinating that. We sure had a lot of fun handing them out yesterday. And I hope everybody enjoyed their delicious feast.
Yeah. You know, it's just such a simple way, but you don't really think about it so much. Like, okay, I've been to the Google campus and the Facebook campus and watched those cafeterias just feed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people every day for free, basically.
Yeah.
So essentially they're buying that food and paying the cooks. And this is a way for them to connect with their employees and keep the restaurants of the city and the area, the region, busy. And I think that was a great idea on their part. I also thank Ethan and his team. And for all my fellow restaurateurs who kind of stepped up and did it. I don't remember how many boxes we did for Tableau yesterday. I think it was about 150 or so.
Yeah, about 100. And almost everybody, you know, like I said, I think it was close to a 4,000 mark, I want to say, was the total number. And so Ethan and everybody did a great job. About 20 different restaurants, I want to say, participated.
That's awesome.
It was very fun to see all the pictures. So
Tableau's been a good local company over the years, very supportive of the restaurant industry. Okay, the ultimate Christmas dinner for two. And I'm just going to go off the one that I'm making for our dinner box, but it's... I'm not suggesting you need to buy ours. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about how to make it special. Because you've been home cooking for almost 9 months now.
Yeah.
You know, many people are buying out, but still at the same time, I bet most people have cooked a little bit more at home than they were used to. If Ballard Market or Shoreline Central Market is any barometer of how many people are cooking at home, holy smokes, those shelves are empty every time I go in there. So there's somebody cooking at home. So anyway... So how do you take, like, you know, I'm sure many people have had a steak and a baker at home. That's a fairly simple meal to make. But how do you make that special? And so we have taken a prime rib, which is in our house pretty typical Christmas Eve, Christmas Day kind of food. And I pre-ordered and I bought one that had the bone left in, the long bone. And you'll see it on some menus as a tomahawk steak because it looks like a hatchet.
Mm-hmm.
Or you'll see it as a cowboy steak. And what I like about the idea of this is that from us making dinner a little bit more special, it's a steak for two or three. I mean, I would only buy one of these if, let's say, Loretta, Jackie, and I were home for Christmas dinner. I would only buy one. If Loretta's husband comes, then I need to buy two. So that makes it special right there. It's like a mini roast. And so I got out the charcoal grill, and I know you were doing some social on it yesterday. And just getting it on the grill and getting it charred on the outside gives it plenty of smoky flavor so that you've taken it to the next step rather than pan frying it. You've got that charcoal smoke on it. Really, really good applewood fire. And so that's pretty simple. That's a simple one. I make a smoked paprika and chanterelle butter for that. So I just roasted chanterelles. I have smoked paprika and butter. And we left the mushrooms out of our box because a lot of people are averse to mushrooms. But for me, that's what I would add to the top of that steak is a little roasted chanterelle mushroom. And I saw them in the market yesterday. You can get them. You just toss them in a little bit of olive oil, some herbs, salt and pepper, and just roast them in the oven. And then I chop them to the size that I want them and mix my paprika and my butter into there. The other thing that's kind of fun to do for this, instead of just a baked potato, make it twice baked. You know, when was the last time you actually made a twice baked potato? And I take a medium-sized potato and I'll bake it just like a baked potato. And then I pull it out and let it cool, but not cold. And then I take and make an oval around the top third of the potato. I don't cut it in half. A lot of recipes you see cut them in half. And I like the way when you just take the top little cap off, you're literally doing that. And then you got to be careful. You kind of spoon out the potato without tearing the skin. And then what we like to do at our house is I'll brush that skin with butter and pop that back in the oven for 10 or 15 minutes until it gets nice and crisp.
Yum.
And then while that's getting crisp in the oven, I mix my potato meat, you know, the flesh of the potato. I mix it with buttermilk, sour cream, whatever. I kind of clean out the fridge. Even eggnog would work. Cheese, all kinds of, you know, all kinds of parm or whatever. Stringy cheese does not work. Like mozzarella, that's not a good mix. But any sort of melting cheese, Beecher's, Flagship, any of those. And I put that and I whip it up nice and I put it right back inside those potato crust, because I'm a skin eater. Do you like the skin on your potato?
The skin on my potato, yeah.
That was always something when I was growing up, we would, on the baked potatoes, you'd eat all the flesh out, Then you'd have that little cup of skin. Mm. You put a big pat of butter and salt in there, and just it's drip so all over your shirt.
Stacy made family meal yesterday at Ballard Warehouse Kitchen, and she included A1 steak sauce for us to drizzle on our baked potatoes. And there was just a nice little pool under my baked potato A1 steak sauce, and that was the perfect little lunch, I will say.
I haven't had A1 in years, and I happened to have it recently when I was down in Arizona a month or two ago, and it was the only sauce left in their fridge down there, so I had some A1, and it tasted good.
It's good. Yeah. A little bite to it. I like it.
The other thing we're doing to kind of fancy up Christmas dinner is making a Baird Eye crab cocktail. So Baird Eye crab is in that same kind of family of Ophelia crab, snow crab. It's not quite like king crab, but it's in that same family. So we're shucking some Baird Eye crab and making just a quick celery leaf and roasted red pepper Baird Eye crab cocktail with a little of roasted tomatillo relish in there. Butter lettuce with winter radish. You know, I like taking that whole head of butter lettuce or bib lettuce or Boston bib, or that's all the different names for it. And I'll take it off and I'll take the leaves off and take the core out, but I won't tear up the lettuce. And I'll rebuild that head of lettuce on my plate so it looks like this fresh head of lettuce. Instead of what we're often left with is a big pile of chopped lettuce, I'll be careful and I'll tear the core out, but I'll rebuild the salad right on top. To make it look like it together. You know, everyone loves ranch dressing.
Mm.
And I can't bring, we can't be fancy and have ranch dressing. So we have to make a buttermilk chive dressing.
Sounds much fancier.
It's exactly ranch dressing, but it sounds so much fancier. So yeah, we're gonna do a little creamy dressing on top. And if you wanted to combine, let's just say this is too many courses for you, just take your salad with the buttermilk ranch and then put your crab right on top as your crab cocktail and make it. And then you've got one course out of two. But still, it's special. You got the fancy crab. You got the big steak. And the steak, when you cut it, here's the trick on cutting a tomahawk or a big cowboy ribeye steak, is that on a ribeye, you have the cap of the steak, of the beef, and then you have the center of the beef, right? And then typically on a ribeye, you'll have a little fat layer in between those two. When you're slicing the beef, you slice the whole steak off the bone, and the bone is kind of your garnish now. But then you slice from the bottom of the bone in a triangle, like pie-shaped wedge, so that you get a little bit of the cap with the center of the steak all the way around your meat, so that somebody doesn't end up with the whole cap. You know what I'm trying to say? Does that make sense?
Yep.
You don't want somebody to end up with the whole cap and then somebody end up with that whole little slice of fat that's in between there, and then somebody end up just with the center of the ribeye. You want a little bit of the outside crust on every piece and a little bit of each part of that steak on every piece. So that's the thing to remember. And let it rest after you make it. I cook mine to 115 degrees in the center and let it rest to 120. That's a medium rare steak. It's going to be a celebration.
You can get those at TomDouglas.com if anybody's interested. They have all of the pre-order links right there, and we're taking orders all the way up until Monday, end of day Monday, the 21st, I believe.
I don't think there's going to be any left on Monday, personally, but we'll see.
Get them now.
Maggie Trujillo is going to join us. She's the executive chef for Heirloom Restaurant, which is right there in the north end of the Pike Place Market next to Cutter's. It's one of the new neighbors that we have down there in the market. So we're going to chat with her on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society Show. We're here in the kitchen at the Hot Stove. We've been doing tons and tons of virtual classes over the last 6 months, and we're coming to the end of the holiday season where we've done many, many corporate gigs, and it's been super fun. We miss you all here, but also we have lovely, fun classes available. I watched Bridget give her, Bridget Charters, who's a guest on our show here, give her gingerbread class the other morning. Oh, my God. That is one sweet show right there.
So much candy. I was able to get the leftovers from that class and build some at home with my kids, but it was a lot of fun. And, you know, Tom, I keep seeing your pictures. We get so many pictures of people on those Zoom classes of you cooking. So it's a screen, a picture of you on a screen. People all over different corporate events and stuff like that, they're having a lot of time cooking at home while they're learning.
Well, hopefully they're not showing all the wine that I drink when I'm giving my class.
I think they're drinking along with you.
I think they are, too. Last night they were. I can tell you that. Okay. We're going to be joined here. Hi, Maggie. This is Tom Douglas.
Hi, Chef Tom. How are you?
Super. This is Maggie Trujillo of Heirloom Restaurant, one of our new neighbors in the north end of the Pike Place Market. So if you don't know exactly where that is, many people know where Cutter's is, mm-hmm. and they know where Etta's is across the street from Cutter's, and the Heirloom is just to the northwest, right across the street from Etta's front door. So welcome to the show, Maggie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
I had the pleasure of meeting you, what, maybe a month ago when we were still open for indoor dining, and I got to run over. I was shucking oysters at Seatown all afternoon, and then that nice young man who's your manager there, I want to say, he's over at the new
El Gaucho.
El Gaucho now.
El Gaucho.
What was his name?
Mock. Mock. He's one of our captains.
He drugged me over there and poured me a big, thick scotch. And
what a kind soul.
I know. And he knew that I had to go back and shuck more oysters. I think he was just hoping I'd put the knife through my hand.
Oh, no. Well, it was great meeting you, and it's great chatting with you on the phone today.
Yeah, so that was good fun. So what are you up to? What's your background? How did you get down to Heirloom? And then we'll go into maybe what you're making around your house for these festive holidays.
Sounds great. I grew up in Idaho, actually. All my family is Pacific Northwest, though, Washington, Oregon. So I went to culinary school in Portland, a year out of college. I went to college, ended up working in a restaurant, fell in love with that, went to culinary school in Portland, and was really an Oregon-based chef, Portland area and then Southern Oregon. For the last several years. Most recent job before Heirloom was farm to table restaurant down in Southern Oregon. And then my husband and I just relocated in 2018, and I accepted the job at Heirloom. So
fun.
Yeah.
So did you say you went to college and then went to culinary school?
I did a year at Boise State and ended up working in a restaurant and just realized I liked that so much more.
Yeah. Well, I knew that I couldn't do the college thing, so I just went straight to restaurants since we're in the same on the same path, really. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, what's Heirloom's specialty?
We specialize in, we have a great connection. So farm to table is really our focus. We have several items on our menu that are seafood, steaks, so high quality proteins, but we really focus on seasonality. We partner with Fall City Farms. And so Amanda, who's our farmer out there, and I really coordinate season to season and year to year on what the growing will look like. We really try to maximize, like cauliflower, carrots. There's some staple things that we can use throughout the year. And then also really honing in on those specialty products when they're available, tomatoes, obviously during the summer, but then she also grows a lot of really great boutique vegetables for us that you don't always get to see. So it's been really fun for me to kind of see some new produce that I'd never worked with in my career. So ground cherries are one of them. They're like this little tomato, almost tomatillo with a little husk that's really sweet. Mm-hmm. Several different kinds of radishes and cucumbers that I hadn't worked with. So for me as a chef, I think that's my favorite part of that restaurant and just really being able to express that through the menu and sharing that with our guests. And that's a little snap of what we do.
Those ground cherries, you don't see them around here much. You see them all over Europe. But you don't really see them in the Northwest here very much.
Yeah, there's like a pop of them for about 3 weeks where you can get them. And whenever we can, we really try to feature those. So,
The farm-to-table thing, I mean, we have our own farm, or maybe you don't know that, but we have our own farm also. And it really, as a chef, it really does, it's a fun driver. It kind of grounds you, no pun intended, to the food that you're serving.
It does. I think what it also does, it connects you with the food, but it's this commitment piece, right? Like you talk to the farmer about what they're going to grow for you. And then I feel really strongly about charcuterie. So that's kind of my example of this is if you're going to use an animal in a dish, then I feel like you owe it to the animal to use the entire thing, mm-hmm. However possible. And I feel the same way about vegetables. How can we maximize this? If I know she's growing, several rows of cauliflower, but I can't sell all that, especially this year, just because it's been such a curveball. How can I pickle it, preserve it, do something cool with it that I can sell for the next couple months? Mm-hmm. I love making pepperonadas and jams and all kinds of things on the menu that kind of add a little bit more depth, but also carry the vegetable further and kimchi, things like that. So and I think it's just really, it's not just the commitment to the food, but it's also that commitment piece to your community, to the person growing it. And it's this whole thing that's really amazing. So
I'm also committed right now to making sure that I use as much of the vegetable as I can. I find in restaurants, especially fancy restaurants, where they are so, I'll just say, piggish about the vegetable. Like, they'll cut the cauliflower in half, take out the core, take off the leaves, do everything so that they have this perfect little floweret. And yet they're throwing away 50% of the plant, you know, and people are starving out there for fresh vegetables. And so I've been trying to really think about and really use the entire head of cauliflower, the entire stalk and everything of broccoli, you know, so that fennel is another one where you people tend to waste, you know, maybe 40% of the fennel, and that's all usable stuff.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, you can use it in purees. You can use, I love cauliflower leaves in kimchi and in kraut. They're incredible in that, and they have this really cool flavor texture that just holds up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, I love processing out the whole vegetable as much as possible. Yeah. So I agree with you.
You're just throwing away, you know, throwing dollars down the compost bin if you don't. Let's jump into what you're making around your house for the holidays. Is there anything, any traditions that you bring to the table? You know, here at the Hot Stove, we always talk about don't let the recipe box die with you. And so we always think that, you know, a recipe is so much more than a list of ingredients and a list of directions. It's really who you are as a person. It's how you grew up. It's what your grandmother taught you. It's what your mom and dad taught you. And that's what a recipe is. And so what recipe kind of really says what Maggie Trujillo is?
Oh, that's such a broad, tough question for me. I think it's just, you know, my husband actually, he was, he and I met in culinary school. So he was a chef for years. You know, now he works more in the cheese selling business. So I think for us, it's always just kind of like, we have, you know, we'll wake up and while we're eating breakfast, we're like, well, what do you want to make for dinner tonight? And it's always this ongoing conversation of at one meal talking about what we're going to make for the next meal. And so I think for us, it's kind of like, well, what if we tried this with it? So we're not always necessarily stuck on, it's like, I might make a fun potato gratin at home and, you know, instead of just serving it, just straight up cut out, you know, roll it up and slice it. Or, you know, I think for me, it's, there's always got to be a really high quality protein and then a veggie focus. But I think when I cook at home, I really just kind of play and see things like, you know, especially when we were kind of under quarantine the first time around, it was like, I was like, huh, I wonder if I tried to make, I started looking at my charcuterie books and I was like, I forgot how easy tasso ham is. I can make that at home. Mm-hmm. I forgot how easy this is. And then, you know, as the restaurants opened back up for indoor dining, it was like, you see tasso ham, you see pates, you see some fun things like that start to pop back up on our menu. Because I was like, oh, I forgot how fun, simple, and beautiful these things are. You know, that it's just like when you have the time to kind of play what you come up with.
Exactly. You know, things like grab locks are super simple. People just perceive them as difficult, but they are super simple.
Yeah. So I think for me, just to pin it down, it's just, I think, I play, you know, at home. It's just like, what are we going to do? What are we going to, and it's so fun to have somebody who's a chef that's also not currently a chef because as a partner, because he cooks a lot, which is phenomenal for me. But coming up this weekend, his family has more of a Spanish background, and his family lived in New Mexico. And so we were talking this year, you know, it's just like, it's kind of a different year. So we're talking about fun things we could do for people for Christmas. So we're actually going to have a weekend of making tamales at our house, which should be a lot of fun.
That sounds so good.
Yeah.
Boy, how do we get on that Christmas list?
I know.
My, Jackie was just, my wife, the farmer, was just shucking all the last of her beans, and they're going into little 1 pound sacks of dried beans for our Christmas list. It's going to be
That's phenomenal.
Super fun, nice. Along with other stuff from the farm. So a little plum mustard, a little strawberry vodka from our strawberry patch.
Yum.
So, you know, stuff like that. Well, Maggie, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. I appreciate your time. Here's to opening our restaurants again, yours and mine and everybody else's, hopefully in January. And stay well.
All right, you too. Thank you so much, Tom. Appreciate being on the show.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Maggie Trujillo from Heirloom Restaurant. Super fun. Good times. All of the above. Up next, we're going to talk about crab cakes. How do you make the perfect crab cake? Right here in the Hot Stove Society on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. All right, we're back. It's the Hot Stove Society. I'm Tom Douglas. Chef Terry has the day off today. We'll be looking forward to having him back next week. Let's talk crab cakes. I was going to spend the day making crab cakes today, but I actually got into the restaurants early this morning and made half of them this morning before class, and then I'll make the other half after class or after the radio show. I'm so used to doing classes in here at the hot stove.
Got to change the nomenclature.
I know, exactly. But it struck me that I used to make thousands of crab cakes every week, every day, and I haven't made crab cakes since the restaurants closed down almost a year ago now, 9 months ago. And it was so fun. It was. I haven't even done a crab cake class, and so I was getting ready for our big crab cake class this weekend, which is sold out and super fun, and everyone's picking up their ingredients and their crab cakes to make with me on Saturday night, I believe, is the crab cake class. So I have to make all the crab cakes. So I started making them, and it really brought back memories. My first time making crab cakes in my life was at the Hotel DuPont in Wilmington, Delaware. And it is just a very fancy place. And back in the Mid-Atlantic, where I grew up, I was born in Cleveland, raised in Newark, Delaware, until I moved away at 18 years old. I moved across the country here. I drove in my car until I ran out of gas. But anyway, at the Hotel DuPont, I worked there for almost a year, and I did so many projects there. You know, my first job there was to shuck oysters and clams and peel scampi for the seafood buffet. The worst job in the world is shucking 400 oysters and 400 cherry stone clams a day. The worst job. Somehow or another, I broke out of that. They always gave that to the new guy. I was a cook's helper. I was making $1 an hour, you know, and so they just kind of move you up as other new people come in. And certainly as other faster oyster shuckers come in, because I was the slowest guy there. But then I started making crab cakes, and a chef there named Jim Irby, he was a big, tall guy, 6'6" or so, skinny as a rail, former Marine drill instructor, had this look about him, and I was just this 16, 17-year-old kid making $1 an hour. Cook's helper was my job title, and so I would just learn all this stuff. And he was feisty, and when he would talk to you, he would be more like, okay, do this and do that, and you know, have your list ready for you. But when I watched him make crab cakes, he used to hold the crab cakes so gently, and he had the big lump, you know, big lump blue crab from the Chesapeake Bay, and it was just a beautiful process that he was doing. And in that part of the world, in Wilmington, Delaware, we added breadcrumbs. Just south in Chesapeake Bay, Baltimore area, you don't add breadcrumbs. And so he would make this nice mayonnaise mix and stir in the crab and all the little bits and pieces of whether it was celery or pepper or parsley or whatever it was, gently fold the crab into this mayonnaise mixture and then into a big pile of literally Wonder Bread breadcrumbs, fresh breadcrumbs, not dried out, not the dried Progresso ones or not fancy bread, just the crappiest white bread breadcrumbs you can imagine. But they served a purpose, right? He'd take the ice cream scoop out this right-sized portion of crab cake, drop them into the breadcrumbs, and then he would lift them up like it was a little chick. You ever held a little chick in your hands?
Sure.
Like
Fragile.
You're just kind of holding it, and then he would gently shape the crab cake with the fingers of his hands and use his thumb to kind of give us a nice round crab cake. And then we would sprinkle the breadcrumbs on the bottom of a sheet pan, a hotel pan, and then lay the crab cake right on top so that the moisture, when it went through, it would just go in through into more breadcrumbs. And the whole breadcrumb idea is where a lot of people got a misconception about crab cakes. Like, theirs are too bready, or, you know, they don't have enough crab meat in their crab cakes. But the breadcrumbs are on the outside, right? Generally, there's a few on the inside for texture reasons, but on this particular crab cake, the breadcrumbs are on the outside. And so the whole idea about the breadcrumbs is you get that custardy, beautiful, crabby center, and then on the outside, you pan fry the crab cake in butter, whole butter, so that the breadcrumbs soak up that and get all golden brown and delicious, and it tastes like brown butter on the outside. When you pan fry the crab without the breadcrumbs, if it has enough egg, it'll hold together, but generally you don't get enough of the butter flavor. And now in Baltimore, where they make Chesapeake Bay style crab cakes, theirs are eggy enough that they just go under a broiler. You put the light ice cream scoop of crab mix on a sheet pan, and you just literally throw it under the broiler, and you broil your crab cakes. Super good, just very different. But anyway, so I was making – where did I get off on this subject? I was making crab cakes this morning, 200 crab cakes, and the process – and I was trying to teach my team at the same time because – this is a new team, right? They don't all know how I make crab cakes. And so the process is really about not making paste out of your crab cakes. That's the number one rule when you make perfect crab cakes, is that you take the beautiful crab meat that you get, and hopefully you got a bunch of legs and knuckles along with the body meat. That's typically what's sold. And then you kind of, if it's wet, you kind of squeeze it gently in your hand, make a ball and kind of squeeze it, take a, you know, excess moisture. You're not trying to wring it dry, but they take some of the excess moisture out, and then you put it in the bowl and you fluff it with your fingers. You literally let it kind of fall through your fingers, and you use the senses in your fingers to feel for shells. Now, anybody who gets a crab cake and they get a shell in it and they get freaked out, it's like, get over it. Eat something else. Go eat New York steak. Because crab has shells, and it's some are going to get through, and that's okay. Just means you're eating a real food product. Just like some fish has a little bit of bone in it. It's just the way it is. So you fluff it with your fingers. You don't break up any of the lumps. And in a separate bowl, you make your binder, because you don't want to be
disrupting
the size crab. Of the crab meat. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason I say that is if you go to a fancy seafood store that might have a separation of crab, if you just buy the leg meat, which, I mean, when you go to Daniel's Broiler, you can get a crab leg cocktail. And that kind of crab is about $100 a pound just for the plain legs. Mm. Whereas the mix that you can get in the grocery store with the body, the knuckle, and the leg is more like $40 a pound. So it's, you don't want to spend the money on all that fancy crab and then break it up into indistinguishable pieces, right? So I make my little mayonnaise mix in one bowl. I kind of fluff and drain my crab in another bowl, and when they're both ready, I fold them in with a rubber spatula so that, I don't break the meat up, right? I fold it in. You can use a gloved hand, but then you lose a lot of the mayonnaise mix on your glove, and you don't know if your proportions are correct. But if you use a rubber spatula, and then I just simply delicately lift them up. I use an ice cream scoop to size them. So I like about a 2.5-ounce crab cake. And I put them in the breadcrumbs, pat, pat, pat. They're best if you can refrigerate them for an hour or two before you try to pan fry them. But here's the other thing. It's the last thing I'm going to harangue upon on the crab cakes. A lot of people say, well, my crab cakes are falling apart. You know, they kind of separate. That's okay. When they don't fall apart, when they're super pasty, is when you've done it wrong. If they fall apart a little bit, that just means you have a big chunk of crab meat that didn't quite stick together. And that's okay. Don't fuss with them. Put them one side down, right? Get a nice golden color at it. Then turn them in the pan and don't turn them again, right? Don't fuss with it. All you got to do is heat them through to about 135, 140 degrees. And now you've got a perfect crab cake. So once you get them made like that, you need to serve them right away. They don't last forever. So all your side ingredients need to be ready to go, all the rest of the things on your plate. But for crab cakes, they're really fun. I'm sure you can find a million recipes online. I have a book called I Love Crab Cakes. But go online. There's 1,000 recipes for crab cakes. And make a couple of different ones. Make your own favorite one. Why not? We have another whole hour to go. Excited about that. Guess who just walked in the door? My wife, Jackie, came in from the farm. So she's going to co-host with me for the next hour. And, of course, we have Brittany Bartleben coming up, Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. It's going to be a big last hour. Stay with us on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio. It's hour number two. We're thrilled to be here with you. I'm Tom Douglas. Chef Terry's got the day off. Hopefully he'll be back next week. We are going to be here for another full hour, like I said. We're going to have our wrap up the hour with Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. Chef Brittany Bartleben is going to play today because she's going to be in the baker's corner. We're excited about that. We don't get to see her as much anymore since she moved on to the Met Markets. So excited about that. Jackie Cross is going to be here.
Hello, everybody.
You often hear me talk about her and the farm over there in Prosser, Washington, and she's come in for a visit. We're happy to have her, but I harangued her into giving up her second cup of coffee, or at least having it here with us, and joining me for the last hour of the show, since Chef Terry can't be here. And Madeline, our producer, has been on the line today. So I don't want to get off too much again on the whole idea of the recipe pass me down, but this particular recipe we're going to talk about now is really one of those recipes that comes with a story, a lifetime story. The recipe itself doesn't resemble anything like it, and your dad was a little bit mad at me about that because I put his picture in, but then I changed his recipe. But tell us about your dad's solstice chowder. Obviously, it's coming up. We're going to serve it at Seatown on New Year's Eve. But tell us about where that came from, why that was an important part of your life growing up.
Well, winter solstice was always my dad's favorite holiday, just because he had, what is it, when you have the sunlight deprivation.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what he had.
And he would get so depressed in the wintertime and stuff, and he knew that on winter solstice the days were getting longer again, and that was a big cause of celebration for him. He started a tradition of doing a seafood chowder and inviting friends over many, many years ago. I remember it as a small child that it was something that we always celebrated. He made a pretty traditional chowder, and he had a complete timeline of when you put in each separate fish. Wait 10 minutes and then add the scallops, and wait 10 minutes and add this, and wait 10 minutes and do that. He had it quite perfected, and it was always served with a lot of champagne.
Mm-hmm. And he loved champagne. Yeah. And so that's when I first joined the family. That's what I remember, is that, okay, you add the fish fillets, and then you wait 10 minutes, and then you add the scallops, and then you wait 10 minutes. Like,
he was very particular about it.
I know, exactly. And so,
it might not have been the best way, but it was his way.
Exactly. And so I think the moral of the story is, with enough good champagne, everything tastes delicious. And so here's this chowder, and I got to say, I didn't have it too much when your dad made it. It wasn't my favorite thing. And he lived in Spokane, or he lived in Hazeldell, or then he was over at the farm. And so I often missed the chowder. And so when we were writing Big Dinners, I love the idea, though, that you're celebrating the return of the sun. And I love that he recognized his issues about depression with the lack of sunlight. Which is one of the reasons why he moved to Prosser, right? Because it's the sunniest place in Washington.
Absolutely.
But I couldn't bring myself to do his exact version. So what I took, and you've heard me espouse it, I took the tradition of the recipe, and then I made it my own, right?
Correct.
Well, it did hurt his feelings a little bit, but I will tell you,
because it was very different.
sort of very different.
But delicious.
But delicious. And so I did some things that were blasphemous to Jim. I think one was the ham hock edition. Do you even remember that I put a ham hock in?
No, actually, he always put bacon in his.
He put bacon in his?
He always started with bacon. So.
Okay. So mine was tomato-based.
Yeah, never would have put tomato in.
Never would have put tomato in there. So I made what I considered a delicious seafood chowder. And, of course, my timing was a little bit different. I don't think mine cooks from, when it comes to when I add the seafood to my solstice chowder, I don't think it cooks more than 10 minutes total, because that hot broth that you have, basically, look at pho. I mean, look what we've learned about pho, right? When we first started going to pho down in Chinatown, when they would slice that raw meat and just pour the hot stock over, that was new for me. When I made beef soup before that, I always browned the beef, braised the beef, broke up the beef, blah, blah, blah. At that time, 40 years ago now? That was fairly new.
Yeah.
For us here, as far as the technique goes. And I kind of use that in a lot of my soups now, where I just let the hot broth do the cooking. So the same way in the seafood chowder. And the last thing we put in are the clams and mussels, because they just kind of pop open at the top. But it is a delicious way, and it's a great memory.
It's a great memory, and we still do it. So we actually are having a virtual celebration with our family and friends on the 22nd this year. So.
Oh, over in Prosser? Mm-hmm. Is that the one I wasn't invited to?
You haven't gotten your virtual invite yet.
Oh, okay. Just checking.
You can be drinking champagne.
Well, Madeline, if you would do me the favor, we're going to put a picture on our Facebook page.
Yep.
The one from Big Dinners, which is one of my very favorite pictures of Jackie's and my daughter, Loretta, and Pop-Up. So if you want to see Pop-Up and his granddaughter, you just look at our Facebook page, and it's really just
a very sweet picture.
Fun memory.
And we'll
that.
Include
he
the recipe.
Adored
as well.
Her so much.
You're going to include the recipe? Yep. Good, for the solstice chowder. Like I said, have it on solstice, but also we're going to serve it on New Year's Eve down at Seatown.
Most importantly, just celebrate the return of the sun.
Yes,
because exactly. That is exciting.
Exactly. So we only have a couple of minutes, but a couple of other things that we put with this in the book, which you might want to think about, Pop-Pop's Perfect Martini, which is why the champagne tasted so good and did its work so quickly, was that he started with a large martini. And so that's something to remember. I paired it with a fennel and radicchio tart, so a little caramelized fennel tart with some bitter radicchio salad right on top. Super good. The other thing that I paired it with, and I can't imagine your dad doing this, but I don't think he disliked it, which was I made, instead of, a lot of time you get garlic bread or something, I made chive scones. And I just thought it was a nice, my chowder's a little bit tomato and creamy, and a biscuit of some sort sounded
worked
good
better
to me.
Than the, yeah.
Yeah, so I made a savory scone to go with it. And then to wrap up the solstice dinner and the seafood chowder, you make this all the time, like a polenta cake.
With the rosemary and
With the rosemary fondant on top.
It's delicious.
And I like polenta cake because it has a bite to it, because I used the coarse polenta, and it has a real crumb to it. And then with the fondant, we just literally blanch the rosemary and then dump it into that lemony, sugary fondant and glaze the top of this polenta cake. So all in all, it's a pretty damn good meal. So,
and the best part is you'll be there on New Year's Eve, but this whole menu special is going to be available at Seatown all the way through Sunday the 3rd.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. But yeah, everybody can check out the menu at seatownmarket.com and pre-order. You can get it for takeout or, like I said, enjoy those
Or make
heaters.
It yourself. We're going to put the recipe right online. So
yeah,
make it
exactly.
yourself, too. It'd be delicious. Up next, it's Cooking Conundrums. Madeline has been combing our Facebook page for thoughts and trials and tribulations from our listeners. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society Show. I'm Tom Douglas. I'm joined by my wife, Jackie Cross, who's stepping in for Terry today. And how's the farm? Last week we talked with you on phone from the farm. You were talking about how to put the farm to bed for the winter. And have you been head first in the seed catalogs at this point?
Starting to look through the seed catalogs.
Late.
I know. Usually I have it done by the end of this month, by the end of December. Yeah, it's been a little upsetting of a year, so I didn't grow as much, so I have a little bit more leftover seed than I had before. Mm-hmm.
And so have you been digging into the seed catalogs yet?
Yes, I have been digging into the seed catalogs. Hope to have all my ordering wrapped up by the end of the month. It's always exciting to read the catalogs because it makes you think of spring and planting, which is always, when it's pouring rain out for 3 days straight, puts a smile on your face.
Although when I saw the weather report a few days ago, you were getting a little snow.
We got a little dusting, and then now it's 55 degrees, so who knows?
Who knows what's going on? We need that cold weather to kill those varmints.
Kill the varmints. We need cold weather to put snow in the mountains to give us water throughout the summer.
That's even more important.
Which is more important.
Yeah. Okay, Madeline, you've been combing our website for some conundrums.
Yes, we posted on our Facebook page to have people send in their Cooking Conundrums Holiday Edition. Everybody cooking up a storm for the Christmas holiday or Hanukkah and all of the above. We had a couple people send in, so we'll get started here. Our listener, Lori, said, with all the cooking we've done the last 9 months, I'm tired of turkey, chicken, ham, and prime rib. She would love some advice and needs some new main dish ideas for Christmas.
Mm. Main dish ideas. Well, it doesn't sound like she sounds like a meat eater or fish eater, so I don't think you really want to go into like portobello mushrooms or things like that. But I would say take some of the food that you don't normally buy at the grocery store. Like at my grocery store, there's always veal, right? Grass-fed veal. It's just a younger cow. Same thing. And then make some scallopini. I just don't think people do this very much. Mm-hmm. You'll see, the top round of the veal cut into thin slices. You take it home, you pound it out into very thin slices, maybe eighth of an inch thick. You get your pan nice and hot, and you give it a quick sear, and then you pull it out and let it rest next to that pan. And then I'm going to add a little cube of butter, or as Terry would say, a nugget of, how does he say, a nugget of butter? Everything's better with butter.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to throw some mushrooms in there, some sliced mushrooms, or I'm going to throw maybe a little bit of chopped fennel and the mushrooms, and I'm going to saute those. I'm going to finish it with a little bit of marsala or Madeira and make a nice little pan sauce. And that's very different than a New York steak and a baker or a prime rib roast, right? It's a very different technique. And at the end of the day, you're eating a much less protein and more of a heavier sauce and a lot of mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think a lot of people don't make pan things like that.
No,
and certainly veal doesn't get used very often. The other thing that's super fun is to create a project. Like Jackie and I did the Prosser Meatball Project, where we made meatballs for a lot of our friends and for our own freezers. And we just made a huge batch. What was it, a 20-pound batch?
Yeah, huge. We had so many meatballs.
You just finished the meatballs at the farm. I still have two packs in our freezer. We gave them away to family. So it's a fun little project to do if you're tired of cooking other things.
What about a whole salmon? Can you get that this time of year?
Oh, yeah. There's lots of salmon available.
That would also be pretty for a Christmas dinner.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Speaking of salmon, our lovely listener, Laura Kleinhaus. Hello, Laura. She said, due to some dietary restrictions, they're going a bit untraditional this year and serving a beautiful black cod. She has a great recipe, but she would love some recommendations for side dishes to go with it.
It sounds like it's a whole black cod, if I'm not...
Maybe.
Well, you're just going to roast it like you'd roast anything, right? But the black cod, if you can, the best black cod is 3 to 5 pounds and larger. Under 3 pounds, it's not fatty enough yet. And the best thing about black cod is the skin. So I personally would probably take and fillet it so that I could sear the skin. And look up my recipe. It's online for Kasuzuke black cod.
And then what would you serve with it?
A little stir fry would be so good with it. Carrots and green beans and mushrooms and stir fried in a wok, hot seared to go with that seared miso inundated black cod.
Mm-hmm.
So good.
I love that sticky ginger rice you did with the steamed salmon too. That was really good. That would be good
for
Christmas.
So all that's available at Wachimaya. Have fun. Take a Saturday and go stroll the aisles of Wachimaya. They've been remodeling the one here in downtown. Anything that your favorite dish with black cod?
No, I mean, we always have the kasuzuke, all those things that are what we normally serve with it. But I have heard great stories about how beautiful the new Wachimaya is down there, so I'm anxious to get down and walk through myself.
A little bok choy, stir-fried bok choy would be really good, too. All right, another question we had from listener Annie. She loved perfect scallop potatoes, but hers always turns out watery. Can you help?
Well, I happen to be standing next to the woman who makes perfect scallop potatoes, so take it away.
I don't know why they would be watery. The only thing I would say is that slice your potatoes thin and then maybe lay them out on a dish towel to make sure that you're soaking up any additional moisture that the potatoes have. I always cook mine from raw. I do a mix of stock and cream, and then just layer it in with all the different herbs and cheeses, and top it off with some crunchy breadcrumbs or something.
Now, that's in my mind, that's au gratin. Is that?
Well, they're pretty similar.
They're pretty similar.
Usually, it depends on whether you add cheese or not.
Scalloped is without cheese.
Scallop can be without, and that would just be the cream and the stock and butter and herbs. And then au gratin, you would put in a layer of
cheese,
melty cheese.
The ones that you make, you brown your onions to a caramelized onion.
Right.
You use fresh thyme,
right.
And you use a little stock. I've watched you make these many times. They're delicious. I would say if your recipe is calling for milk at all, drop the milk and use cream instead.
Use cream, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that won't break as much and won't be that watery kind of.
And you just want to barely put in enough liquid to just barely come up to the top of the potatoes.
All right. Listener Callista is making timpano. What type of pan is best?
And that is ambitious.
It's ambitious. And can you bake it in a stainless steel bowl?
Yes, you can bake it in the bowl. The pan itself is usually an enameled steel pan from Italy. We buy them here when we do our timpano classes here. We buy them for each of the participants. They're only $3 or $4 a piece online. And you just look under timpano bowl and you'll get an idea of what it looks like. But yes, you can make them in a stainless steel bowl, and it they're a little bit different shape. They're supposed to be a little bit like a drum. So they're the ones that the classic ones are a little bit more vertical than, say, a big wide mouth stainless steel bowl. Certainly go for it. Give it a try. All you're going to do is, you know, you lay the big sheets of pasta and you leave them up over the edge. So whatever pan you're using would work in that scenario, conceptually. It is nice to have the traditional pan, though.
All right. Last question from our listener, Stephanie. She just bought herself a sous vide element. Do you have any favorite proteins or recipes that you like to sous vide that would be good for Christmas, maybe even salmon or beef?
Boy. You know, sous vide is, do you have any thoughts?
No, I don't sous vide.
I don't sous vide much either. Chef Terry would know this better. Mm-hmm. But what I would suggest is that, you know, I would say maybe start with short ribs. And follow a recipe along with short ribs, and typically it's 72 hours in a water bath. And so that's something that the average person just doesn't think far enough ahead of time. So if you are thinking that way, and if you've got the equipment and you got the bags, you buy the short ribs, you get that whole process done and give somebody that bag for Christmas, then all they have to do is give it a quick sear when it comes out of the bag and heat it up, and it's done for them.
Yeah, we're going to do that for Christmas dinner. We're going to do duck breasts, and we're going to sous vide duck breasts and then allow for the quick sear. And I think the sous vide will keep my father entertained. He'll just sit and stare at it for 72 hours.
What is your recipe call for how much time?
You know, I think Ryan was going to look it up. I want to say it is almost, you know, I don't know off the top of my head. I want to say it was a good,
at least 24.
At least 24 hours. It's going to depend on if we can get fresh duck breasts or not. That's going to be our challenge that I'm calling around for today. So,
well, try what's his name out in Woodinville, Seattle Specialty
Meats.
Yeah. I think that there's that shop out there in Juanita, Woodinville area.
Yeah.
Juanita
Bothell.
Kind of that area on that road. All right, up next, the chef Brittany Bartleben has joined us in the house. We're so excited to have her from the Met Markets on Cairo Radio. Coming up, the Baker's Corner, the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's time for the Baker's Corner here at the Hot Stove Society. I'm Tom Douglas, joined by my wife, Jackie Cross, the farmer-in-chief. And, of course, Chef Bartleben has graced us with her presence, taking a few minutes off from her hectic schedule over at the Metropolitan Markets.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
It's still hard for me to say the Metropolitan Markets, by the way.
It's hard to hear it.
Yeah. We miss you at the Dahlia Bakery. I miss the Dahlia Bakery. I'm going to try and get it reopened in January. We're going to see what happens, but that's my goal.
That's great.
My goal was before Christmas.
Right, yeah.
I have adjusted that goal.
Right, yeah. Set some realistic goals, yeah.
Anyway, Baker's Corner, holiday cookies. You were posting some stuff online, so we thought we would jump right in there. Jackie used to make beautiful holiday cookies. She hasn't in a few years. Remember all the ones you used to put in the freezer?
I used to make a ton, but we don't eat them anymore because... I mean, if I have them around, then I eat them all.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm running into that problem myself.
So, unfortunately.
Yeah, let's talk holiday cookies. Where do you begin?
Well, you begin with looking at your assortment. You'd think it'd be easy. You just bake off some of my favorite cookies and give them to people. Mm-hmm. But you need to be a little bit more thoughtful about that. First of all, you want to think about shelf life. If you're going to be giving these cookies away, you don't want people to have to hurry to eat all of them before they go bad. You want them to be able to enjoy them throughout.
How do they go bad? Just stale or
stale?
Do
they go stale. Yeah. For instance, a chocolate chip cookie would never be something I put in a holiday baking. You know,
because it goes stale in 24 hours.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Exactly. You want something that they can take their time to enjoy.
Okay.
So you want to think about that first of all. And then you want to think about an assortment of textures, too. I like to have something sort of sandy and tender, something crispy, something soft and chewy. And then I like something just sort of fruity. I went a little, I did something non-traditional. I made hamantaschen this year, which is usually served at Purim. But I just love, it's almost like a tiny galette, a tiny fruit galette.
You're talking a foreign language to me.
Okay, Purim, so hamantaschen is, it's a simple pastry dough that you cut into a circle. And then you put, I used apricot, basically a fruit filling made from a dried fruit. And then you fold the dough up around it so it's like a triangle.
Oh, I know.
So they're very delicious and provide them with something different, something fruity, and
because of the fruit filling, they probably last a little longer.
They last quite a while, yeah. And so you want something that's going to have a long shelf life, has an assortment of flavors, and then you also want something chocolate.
Uh-huh.
What I went for this year, and what I tend to always go for, is Dory Greenspan's World Peace Cookie. Just Google it. It's famous. It's a legendary cookie.
Uh-huh.
It's a very simple chocolate cookie. It's like a chocolate shortbread cookie with, so there's cocoa powder in the dough and then chunks of chocolate as well. Butter, sugar, flour, salt, vanilla. That's literally it. But there's something about this cookie. It's crispy. It's chewy. It's intensely chocolatey. Go for a good cocoa powder. I like Valrhona cocoa powder. To me, that just is the best. And it has a long shelf life. And you can freeze the baked cookies and
so
it's delicious.
Not, is that the crinkle cookie that we used to
That's serve? No, that's not the crinkle cookie, but that would be my next suggestion if you don't want to do the World Peace cookie. The crinkle cookie, when you roll it in powdered sugar, so delicious. That that also has a couple more days shelf life than a traditional chocolate chip cookie, and it just kind of looks like a chocolatey snowball. It's really pretty.
So you're talking about all these for, like, if you're going to send out to your neighbors a little Christmas thank you. Let's take a look at it from a little bit different angle and more of the angle that Jackie used to do, which is she used to make a certain amount of rolls of cookie that she put in wax paper and then put them in the freezer. And then on a daily basis, you simply slice off.
Slice and bake.
Few, and then you have them fresh baked.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty cool to have them in the freezer
that's
ready to go.
The smartest way to do Christmas cookies, I think, because you can just make the dough whenever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did, is I found myself at home for 2 weeks because I came into contact with somebody that had COVID.
Mm-hmm.
So I was quarantined. So I was like, well, I'm just going to make my cookie doughs. So you can load up the freezer with a slice and bake cookie. And then you're never going to be able to give away all your cookies in one day. So it's as you can, bake them off and put together a little cookie tin.
So
for
tell
your
me, you know, so I'm thinking about this and I'm thinking I got this rock solid frozen log of cookie, but it does slice even when it's frozen, though, right?
I think it's easier to refrigerate it, pull it from the freezer and let it sit in the refrigerator. And even then, it sort of depends on the cookie, but say it's just a simple butter shortbread cookie, pull it out and let it sit on the counter for a few minutes and just temper it slightly. Because sometimes they can tend to crumble
and it can go back and forth to the freezer.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's a very stable.
Do you remember your favorite one of that variety? I remember like the poppy seed ones.
The poppy seed one, and then usually it was just a basic sugar cookie, but then I would roll it in different, like the chopped nuts on one, or
crunchy sugars
and stuff like that. So you could bake off, you know, four or five of them that all have a different sort of.
That's a really, really great way to sort of jazz up what would be a simple butter cookie, but so delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have to talk about cutout cookies for Christmas time and the holiday
let's
season.
Talk
that's
about
we
it.
Have to. That's
yeah.
I personally think the easiest thing to do with a gingerbread cookie or a sugar cookie is to take your dough directly from the mixer and put it in between sheets of parchment and roll it while it's soft.
To the thinness that you want.
Exactly. Uh-huh. To the thinness that you want. Then throw that in the fridge and let it get cold and then cut them out. It's so much faster. And
well, that's
sure
kind of
you,
interesting
yeah,
little shortcut
good.
There.
Yeah.
And then what are you, when you have all the extra dough in between the cookies, so you just re-roll that then
in between wax paper
again?
Exactly. Reuse your parchment paper. Use that same parchment paper to bake your cookies on. I mean, I did hundreds of cookies. And I think I only ended up using like 6 sheets of parchment
now,
paper.
Now, let's be clear here. You had a sheeter in that bakery. And I know how you rolled that.
I'm talking about
at
home, Tom.
I know how you rolled that out.
I made over 100 cookies in my home kitchen.
Oh, in your home kitchen.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I have photographic proof.
I saw pictures.
Yeah. So, yeah, you really don't have to use a ton of parchment, but it is necessary for cutout cookies.
And then how do you get, I'm a big fan of the trashy kind of off the side of the Domino's powdered sugar box icing.
Absolutely.
But that's not the kind that gives you that perfect edge. You know, like the edge that you see on Martha Stewart's cookies that are so perfect. There's nothing out of place. How do you get to that fancy
That's very clean look. Yeah. It's the same icing that you get off
Is
the Domino.
Really?
Yeah, it's just royal icing. It's powdered sugar, egg white, maybe a little lemon juice.
That's not the Domino's box.
Oh, what's the Domino's box? Maybe
that's
I don't
powdered
know.
Powdered sugar and water.
Water. Okay, so that's what I make because my son is allergic to eggs. Powdered sugar, water, pinch of citric acid so it's not so intensely sweet. It is intensely sweet. Also, a little bit, this is my my thing with sugar cookies too, just a teeny bit of almond extract. For me, it just makes it delicious. So what you do is you put some of that icing in a piping bag and pipe your border around the cookie and then fill that with the icing. It's called flooding. And so that border will sort of protect it from sliding off. It'll make it look really clean and simple.
That's kind of what the graffiti artists do too, right? They paint a border and then they fill in their name.
You're essentially becoming a graffiti artist with these cookies. I personally go a little easier with it. I just dunk my cookie in the bowl of royal icing and then sort of take my finger.
So it
and
has
clean
to
it
be
up.
Thin enough to do that.
Thin enough, but it can be thick. It can be fairly thick. You just have to let it run off. And you have to work quickly because it will set up very quickly. I was doing this with my son on Saturday. And so I would dip a cookie, hand it to him, and he would throw an ungodly amount of sprinkles on it. And
I think the Domino's sugar box also has some butter in it because it lasts.
Oh, does it? Okay.
It lasts. So you can ice a cookie with a little spatula, and it'll stay soft for quite a while.
Right,
that has
okay.
to be some sort of fat.
So that's definitely not a royal icing then. This what we're talking about would be a royal icing. The Domino's sugar cookie, it's delicious, but it's more of a frosting.
It's trashy good.
That's
the highest compliment out of my vocabulary.
Yeah. And I grew up on some of those trashy Christmas cookies. Like we used to do the cornflake wreaths where you mix it with melted butter.
The
red hots on it.
Oh, yeah.
I loved them as a kid. I don't think I could get through one now. But yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I also love a holiday cookie contest. I mean, we did this every year at the Dahlia Bakery. I was sad to not do it this year, but the Metropolitan Market did one this year. It's really cool. They asked the community for their favorite holiday cookie recipes. They were submitted. Our culinary artists, or our culinary arts and community specialists, tested all of the recipes. We picked our five favorite ones, and they're on our website now. So if you're looking for some fun recipes to make, we found the five best.
Some ideas.
Yeah, there's a Turkish sand cookie that looks just beautiful. Cranberry coconut chews. And there's a peanut butter filled chocolate cookie as well that looks amazing. So, yeah, Linzer
we
cookies.
We had one that my mother made. I've never made it since, from growing up with it, called a pecan tassie. You know anything about
it? I've heard of that. Yeah,
It's kind of like you put it into a tiny, miniature muffin cup with the dough, and then you fill it with almost like a pecan pie filling. And you just bake them.
It's like a tiny little pecan pie. They're delicious.
Really tiny. Yeah.
Speaking of it, pecan sandies, Mexican wedding cookies, Russian tea cakes, whatever you call them. My friend Kat calls them aspiration balls. They're those little pecan cookies that are tossed in powdered sugar. That's my favorite holiday cookie.
Yeah. Is it really?
Yeah. Simple, it's delicious, and it looks like a snowball.
And they melt in your mouth.
They melt in your mouth, exactly.
Yeah, that wouldn't be my favorite. I mean, I like them fine, but that's not my favorite.
Oh, so good.
All right, fine.
Yeah, you can go to the Metropolitan Market website, go to the recipes page and search cookies, and there's all sorts of fun stuff on there.
Lovely. All right, you're going to stay for a little bit?
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to do a little food for thought tasty trivia challenge, and Jackie's going to join in this time.
Ooh, fun. Let's take him down, Jackie.
Uh-oh.
Wait a second. No, she's a player. She's not like your teammate.
No, I know, but I don't really care as long as you lose.
How about
love
that?
You, Brittany.
How about that? That is just lovely. We'll be right back on this holiday, Good Feeling Holiday edition of Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society. This is the radio show with Tom Douglas, Jackie Cross, and Brittany Bartleman has stayed for trivia because she's feeling like she's ready to pounce. She's feisty today. This tasty trivia is brought to you by Rub With Love, handcrafted, versatile rubs, sauces, and mustards that add a flavorful kick and a whole lot of love to just about any meat, fish, or vegetable, made fresh in Ballard by our team. Get an early jump on your holiday shopping and send friends and family around the country our Rub With Love gift packs.
We have a full selection of flavors and combinations that are perfect for your favorite home cook. You can visit TomDouglas.com/shop, or you can go to Bartels. You can go on online anywhere. You can go to any grocery store. We got rubs and sauces everywhere. What's our prize today, Madeline, and who's going to win it?
All right. We are playing for listener Annie Robbins. She sent in one of her kitchen conundrums, so thank you for sending that in, Annie. You will be winning a jar of our smoky barbecue rub, our shallot mustard, and ancho molasses barbecue sauce. A nice little flavor trio for the new year to cook with.
I recognize that's our Grill Master Pack.
Our Grill Master Pack, exactly.
And so, you know why it has this, the mustard in there? Because Chef Terry loves a mustard marinade on when he grills, and yum. So I've kind of incorporated my two, which is the rub and the ancho sauce, and his, which is the mustard.
So. Ah, that sounds delicious, and so she will win that prize. Whoever wins the most questions correctly here, we're going to do three rounds, and I believe, Tom, this is looking like your home for the holidays household, right? It's all the girls.
Yeah, it's all the girls against me. And just remember, Bartleben, whoever loses has to pay for the shipping to her house.
That's true. All right, Brittany, since you're the pro here, you're going to go first.
All right.
Question number one, how do you know if cranberries are ripe?
They'll float.
They'll float, or they bounce like rubber balls.
Oh, that's
something
never...
I did not know of either. They bounce test onto cranberries to ensure they are ripe. Other ways is if they float or they're firm and have dark red color.
You know, when we fly down the Bandon in my friend's jet, we fly right over the Bandon the cranberry bogs. And they're all red. You can see them all floating.
So cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. I love cranberries. Underrated.
Underrated. I'm obsessed. All right. Question number two. Nuts are the most common what?
I don't know how to answer that.
I know.
I would say allergy.
It is.
Oh,
is
okay.
Right.
Allergen. Oh, okay.
Yeah, food allergen.
Yeah.
Around 1% of the U.S. population has an allergy to a nut, and no one's exactly sure why. Your son's allergic to eggs and...
Eggs, dairy, and cashews.
There you go.
Yep. Have you thought about trading them in for a Ford?
Several times. Yeah.
You are a good mother. That is a sweet job right there. All right. What falling fruit supposedly inspired Isaac Newton to write the laws of gravity?
I'm going to guess the apple.
That is correct. He was sitting below an apple tree when an apple fell on him. Question four. From what city in Germany do we get the name of one of America's favorite foods?
Hamburg.
Correct.
Wow, I don't think I would have got that one.
Me either. Okay, this one's for you. Which famous elf made the claim that elves must stick to the four main food groups being candy cane, candy, candy corns, and syrup?
That would be Buddy the Elf.
Buddy the Elf. Good job.
How did you know that?
It's from Elf.
It's like Will
Ferrell. Oh, is that movie?
Yeah.
Oh, I've never even watched that movie.
Oh, you must.
Oh, my God.
You must.
It's
not
a classic.
It is a classic.
Classic line. Yeah.
Buddy the Elf.
Will Ferrell. It's a giant elf.
Well, see, I thought that I was competing against people with good taste, and apparently not.
I know the crowd. I would never have given that question to you. All right, Jackie, you are up next. Brittany, I believe you got, should we give a half a point for the food allergen?
I didn't get the food allergen.
No. Okay. Matter of fact, she traded her child. No. We traded her child.
Yeah, exactly. No.
All right, so you're 4 out of 5.
All right.
Jackie, in cooking, if you are paring a carrot, what are you doing to it?
Peeling it.
That is correct. I did not know that term, actually. What is the culinary term for...
I thought you were putting like carrots next to each other.
You and you together. You and you. What is the culinary term for according to the menu or by the card?
A la carte.
That is correct. Well done.
I hate when I get smoked on this segment.
And by girls, too.
Whatever.
Yes. Ooh. What cheese is traditionally used on a Reuben sandwich?
Swiss.
Well done. 3 for 3. Which fruit is traditionally put inside a Christmas stocking?
Oranges.
Oranges or tangerines.
Do you want to just take a second and think about these things? Or...
Oh, this is a lightning round. She's got
mine. Mine has always had coal. I'm not sure what happened. What happened to my Christmas stocking?
It's a different type of fruit.
It's just that orange had been there for a very long time and turned black.
We do find some old peels I find whenever I bring out my stockings. What should be eaten on each day of the 12 days of Christmas to ensure good luck for the year ahead? It's an old English tradition, supposedly.
Eaten each day for the 12 days of Christmas. I don't know that.
That's
partridge.
A mince
pie. In a pear tree.
A mince pie?
Yeah. According to the tradition, you should eat one mince pie on each of the 12 days of Christmas to bring good luck. It's technically illegal to eat mince pie on Christmas Day in England. because the 17th century Oliver Cromwell banned Christmas pudding, mince pies, and anything to do with gluttony. So there you go.
Wow. And the monarch still survives.
Still survives. Okay, so it's all tied up. 4 out of 5. Jackie, you did very well.
Thank you.
Yeah. Tom, a little too well.
You have a chance to win here. How many fluid ounces make up a half gallon?
Well, 128 is a gallon, so that would be 64.
Well done. I was going to test your math this morning. Which vegetable is also known as a courgette?
A zucchini.
Oh, that was good.
Oh, you weren't expecting that one, were you?
What is the biggest supermarket chain in the United States?
Kroger.
Dang it. That is correct. In the classic Christmas song, what was roasting on an open fire?
Oh, for crying out loud.
Why are you crying? Your son's allergic to cashews, not chestnuts.
All right, 4 for 4. True or false, unmarried women in England have been known to eat gingerbread husbands for luck in meeting the real thing.
Absolutely. You can't make that stuff up.
That is true. Tom, my Christmas present to you is a winning crown.
5 for 5.
There's a first time for everything. So
that means Bartleben and Jackie Cross have to pay to ship. So who won our prize again?
Annie Robbins will be receiving our Grillmaster set, which includes smoky barbecue rub, shallot mustard, and ancho molasses barbecue for all the grilling that she's going to be doing in January.
Well, if you don't have your grill out in January, then you're not a griller. You're not, like, by
a grill master.
You're not a grill master, yeah, no. By definition, because grill masters grill year-round.
That's true.
So right? Matter of fact, I was out grilling yesterday, huge cowboy steaks with you on the dock at the warehouse while we were testing out our tomahawk ribeye chop. So good. Can hardly wait. All right, this tasty trivia is brought to you by Rub With Love, handcrafted versatile rubs, sauces, and mustards that add a flavorful kick and a whole lot of love to just about any meat, fish, or vegetable. And you can find them, those Grill Master Packs, at tomdouglas.com/shop, which is always a good place to be.
Yeah, they make for a good gift to send to family and friends as well.
I know, we have a little knife set, so we've got all sorts of fun little rub things. If you want to be part of the show, you can join the community on Facebook at Hot Stove Society Radio Show. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. The show is produced by our team, Madeline Pennington and Amy Richardson. Sound and production by Sean McFadden. Thank you, Sean. And our editor is Sean Merry Christmas Del Torre. And remember, if you miss any episode of our Hot Stove Society show, you can go to Cairo 97.3 FM's the app. Or you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app. Thanks for listening.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.